Wouldn't you love to get paid for doing what you love to do? If you're ready to move on to what's next, join us for Circles of Change with Dr. Zara Larson. Our uplifting live talk show on Saturday mornings from 10 to noon will have you circling back, not running in circles, to pull your experience forward in new ways. Advance your career, plus help others with theirs. Join us Saturdays, 10 to noon, right here on 104.1 The Truth, for pragmatic advice and unconventional wisdom. Circles of Change with Dr. Zara Larson, where your path is created by walking on it. Welcome to our second hour here on Circles of Change, and I want you to know we're going to go back to the future, and there's going to be no turning back to the way things were, because with a pleasure to welcome David Houle on the line. Good morning, David. How are you today?
Good morning. I'm fine.
Very good. Let me introduce Dave. He's a futurist and author of a highly regarded blog called evolutionshift.com. He currently is a futurist in residence. What a great title. At the Ringling College of Art and Design in Sarasota, Florida, and also has a second residence in the greater Chicago area. David is a graduate of Syracuse University in art history, after which he traveled the U.S. in a van and backpacked around the world for 2 years before landing with the entertainment industry, which is where he was based for the next 20 plus. In addition to winning 2 Emmys for a nationally syndicated children's TV program, creating the show Investigative Reports and American Justice, David was a member of the executive team that launched MTV, Nickelodeon, VH1, and CNN Headline News. So what a thrill for me to get the chance to speak with you today. He's a sought-after lecturer, and David has advised over 2,000 CEOs and business owners on 6 continents. So I imagine your frequent flyer accounts are pretty strong then, Dave. He's also author of He's also author of The Shift Age, which was a term he first coined over 5 years ago, The New Health Age, and he's contributed to NPR, The Oprah Magazine, and The Huffington Post. It's David's new book that we're going to talk about today, though, Entering That Shift Age, The End of the Information Age, and The New Era of Transformation. So he's going to help us really identify and explain the dynamics and forces that have come and continue to transform our world, and also get some observations on how these changes together have become a blueprint for the future into the next 20 years. And in fact, that's probably where I'd like to start. You know, it's one thing for all of us to be inundated with these futuristic articles and the whys and wherefores, Dave, but what your book does, an interesting story, is it creates a system into which we can hang all these different pieces. When you started writing the book, was it you had the system to start with, or did you see the system evolve through understanding the components?
Well, I wouldn't say I have a system. Back in the early part of this century, I sensed that something new was about to happen. And as you know, because I think you've mentioned that you've read Toffler, mm-hmm. there were three ages. There was the agricultural age, the industrial age, and the information age. And I sense in this new century that we're about ready to leave the information age because so many dynamics had changed. You know, there was a global economy, the Cold War was over, there was connectivity, there was climate change, or all these things. So I started looking around, and I went back and I read all the greats, Toffler, McLuhan, Fuller, and they were somewhat diffuse into this century. So I, with Toffler kind of as my conceptual ancestor, I said, well, we're entering a new age. And I called it the shift age because I felt that everything was going to be in a rate of shift. The prior ages, obviously, agricultural, industrial, and information, were all based around products, and I figured this was much more universal. And so then I tried to figure out, because all ages have particular characteristics or forces, what the forces that would be the dominant forces reshaping humanity in a shift age would be. And that's where I came up with your reference to the system, which are the 3 forces of the shift age: the flow to global, the flow to the individual, and the accelerating electronic connectedness of the planet. So it's not like it's kind of like I wanted to identify the forces. And you know, since I came up with this concept in 2006 and started talking about it in 2006 and 2007, I found that there's a universality, regardless mm-hmm. of whether I'm talking to communicators or theater people or energy people or education people. They all say, God, those forces are changing our business.
And could you explain to us, and of course, the global one is probably obvious. I mean, we've all read Thomas Friedman, The World is Flat, and other things about global nature of things, and as well, of course, technology, of course, you're coming out of the media. The fact that CNN was already on the beach to welcome our troops when Desert Storm started, so we already knew that happened. But the idea of this flow to the individual, what do you mean by that?
Well, in the last 40 years, there's been an explosion of choice.
There we go.
We have more ways to watch TV. We have more ways to read books, listen to music, brands of toothpaste. And whenever there's an explosion of choice, the power moves from the producer to the consumer, from the institution to the individual. So we as individuals have more power than we've ever had before. If you think about it, you know, the power comes from each individual. Now, it used to be in the last century, media was produced by media companies. Early part of this century, media was produced by companies, you know, blogs and everything. Mm-hmm. Now every individual is a media company with Twitter, Facebook, mm-hmm. YouTube. So that's just an example. So we're getting organized around all of us and each of us, both of those being amplified by the accelerated connectedness of the planet.
Organizing around all of us and each of us. What a thought.
Yeah. So, well, the thing about global, which I want to come back to you, because people immediately put that into, oh, we're in a global economy, which is kind of what Friedman's saying. It's way beyond that. We're in the global stage of human evolution.
Okay.
We've gone from family to tribe to village to city state to nation state. Only remaining boundaries for now are planetary. So we're in the global stage of human evolution, which means everything is getting organized around a global construct, which also means that the word globalization is no longer just an economic term, but it's a term describing what will happen to most of human society, culture, politics, and economics.
Mm-hmm. Well, you certainly see that. And in fact, what's so encouraging, because I know you've done a lot of work and reflection on the impact of the millennials and even those younger than them, is that they're totally fearless in all of that. They wouldn't dream of not playing a multiplayer video game with their friends in Korea based in Tucson, Arizona. It's just a natural
That's
part
exactly
of life.
Right.
The other piece I mentioned, of course, in our introduction, that now you're a futurist in residence. Tell us what that role is all about.
I came up with the term. The president of Ringling, Larry Thompson, accepted it. And the reason we came together is Ringling College of Art and Design is all about creativity.
Yeah.
They're one of the top digital film schools, computer animation schools, have the most wired campus in the United States of America. And all about creativity. And I travel around the world as the CEO's futurist, as you mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, CEOs want creative thinking. So creativity, so as the CEO's futurist, I wanted to stand at Ringling and say, I'm not futurist residence at a technology institution. I'm in a creative institution. Creativity is singly the most important quality needed in America now and for the next few decades. And that's what CEOs, Fortune 500 CEOs have been saying. They want people who think creatively. So, you know, I oversimplify things, but for anybody who's familiar with the left brain, right brain concept, left brain being rational thought, right brain being creative, intuitive thought, the 20th century was clearly a left brain century, science, mm-hmm. Technology. And the 21st century was a right brain century. How are we going to creatively redeploy all the inventions we created in the last century?
And in fact, innovation meaning not necessarily inventing, but innovation meaning taking solutions from other spaces and applying them to a different opportunity.
That's right. You know, in the information age, the cliche was content is king. Cliche because everybody said it, but it's true. The parallel cliche in the shift age is context is king.
Context.
We live in an ever more contextual world. So one of the five contexts through which all of humanity's future will be viewed is retrofitting the 20th century. Simply put, we in America and the developed countries of the world have to go back and retrofit the 20th century. Humanity quadrupled its population in 100 years, never been done before. And basically, if you were to take a snapshot, where you are, where I am, January 1st, every single century since 1000, we wouldn't see much change until on 1800 and then 1900. But the snapshot between 1900 and 2000, we paved the planet. We've taken everything in the 19th century that we invented and institutionalized it. So, for example, the internal combustion engine was institutionalized into transportation, right? So
right.
Here we have to go back and change all this stuff. It's not sustainable.
Interesting thought. So content is king, but now context is key. I think the idea, too, of this is king. Is absolutely is king. The right brain, left brain side is what also it begs to see as an opportunity for those two sides to be partnered stronger in perhaps some untraditional ways. right, in terms of businesses. And so, you know, the mere fact that here you are coming out of the media community, and by the way, like you said, content is king. You obviously grew up in that business for 20 years, and now going and shifting your knowledge and bringing that into where context is king is a great crossover possibility for you personally.
Well, absolutely. I mean, that's the thing. I wrote a book on transforming K-12 education, and I speak to a lot of education audiences, and I get absolutely nuts when politicians talk about STEM, you know, statistics, technology, engineering and math.
Yeah, right.
We need more STEM. Right? That happened in 1957 with Sputnik. You know, we need creativity. We stamp creativity out of our children at an early age. And so, you know, whenever you hear the word STEM, it's a 20th century thing. We need, I don't care how many engineers get graduated, you know, out of China. They're all industrial engineers, and they don't have much creativity or innovation. And by the way, you know, I'm sick of the word innovation, but everybody likes to use it because they want to be innovative. If you think about what innovation is, creativity precedes it. Innovation is nothing more than creativity being introduced into the marketplace. So creativity precedes innovation. If you want innovation, you have to be creative. And the thing I want to point out is, you think about the Fortune 500, right? Fortune magazine, the classic magazine for the corporate elite. And who did they give the CEO of the Decade award to in 2009? Steve Jobs.
Steve Jobs, exactly.
A right brain designer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it really is a time for America to lead. I mean, we're the most creative and innovative country in the world, right? We're the most entrepreneurial country in the world. So we need to double down on that to keep this country great over the next 20 years. That's
right,
why it's so frustrating.
Right. Now, of course, you find yourself here, David, at this point of your career, indeed, being based out of and collaborating with an art and design school. You also studied art history back in the day at Syracuse University. Did it ever dawn on you that you'd probably be circling and back and connecting in this way? Your own career journey?
Well, no. I mean, when I graduated from college, I didn't know I was going to be a futurist in this century. but yeah, I mean, when I graduated from college with a BA in art history, people, what are you going to do with an art history degree? And my basic answer was, well, I'll have a better aesthetic outlook on life. I'll make my life a work of art. And by the way, if you ever want to learn about any culture, look at their art. Their art precedes reality. And also historically, if you go back and you study civilization's art, you really learn what their values are.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, it's really nice to come back. And one of the things I do is I'm guest lecturer at Ringling. So I, you know, spend 12 to 15 guest lectures a semester talking to some of the most creative 18 to 23-year-old millennials.
Absolutely.
On the planet.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a gift for me.
Absolutely. Of course, I'd mentioned to you that my son as well is in art school. He's a freshman in art school. And with my husband and I both being engineers, although closet artists probably most of our life as well. So, you know, I've got both the STEM and the other, okay? But also that
right.
Jake's, the amount of social pressure initially that was there to say, well, you're going to invest that much money and let your child go to art school? And I was dumbfounded when people would say that, to say, but don't you understand that's the action for the future?
Yeah, art school is a misnomer. Most people have legacy thinking, so they're thinking about the old, let's learn how to paint.
Right.
And
right.
What it's really now, it's about everything's gone digital.
Oh, yeah.
And you see the movies, you see the art, you see the music, you see projections, you see every single art form is being transformed from technique to technology. And as technology increases, the need for creative use of it increases. And it's really pretty stunning that if you take all the creative industries, I forget what the Ringling statistic was, it's a multi-billion-dollar industry in the United States, just creativity. Just to do something like Avatar, or create the next iPhone, you need a lot of artists.
Oh, you bet.
I remember one time, before Steve Jobs died, I used to ask audiences of CEOs, who's the most famous artist in the world? And they'd kind of grope with the answer. Van Gogh, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
When I taught my first class at Ringling, I asked the same question, and all 14 of them said, Steve Jobs.
Right. To understand, broaden your view.
People listening, people listening to us now probably have an Apple product, which is a work of art, which is one of the reasons we buy them.
Mm-hmm, that's exactly right. Well, there's another part of your story, by the way, for our listeners who may have just tuned in. We're speaking with David Houle, and his book is called Entering the Shift Age, the End of the Information Age, and the New Era of Transformation. You can learn more about David's work, by the way, by going to evolutionshift.com. David, the story behind the story about this book in and of itself, you also broke the rules when it came to even making this book. Could you talk about source books and the new agile publishing model that you all used?
Sure, I'd be glad to. I speak a lot about transformation. Mm-hmm. And the dictionary definition of transformation is change in nature, shape, character, and form. In 2010 to 2020 is the transformation decade. So most of humanity's institution and much of our thinking is going to change its nature, shape, character, and form. So when I went to publish this book, I said to Dominique Rocca, the visionary publisher of Sourcebooks, I want to do this differently, and she agreed, because the publishing model is broken. You know, it's just like getting a record contract in 1999 before mm-hmm. Napster. It's fallen apart. So the Ezra publishing model meant that on January 1st, my ebook, my full ebook was published. January 15th, my print book was published. But between Labor Day last year and December 31st, 12 mini ebooks encapsulating most, if not all, of the content of the book were published. 10 of them at 99 cents. You want to read about the future of education? You can get that book. You want to read about the future of power? You want to read about the ascendancy of women? You want to read about the shift age generations? You can get it. And I think that is going to be one of the models of the future. If you think about how you buy music today, you don't go out and buy an album, you buy a song.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there will be books that might have 10,000 copies sold that have chapters or parts of them that will sell 25 or 30,000. So it's called the agile publishing model. That's just a term that the publishing industry uses. But basically, to produce many ebooks before the entire book is published, allowing people to sample the book, buy what just what they want, or to wait and get the whole book. However they want to buy it, we serve it up for them that way.
Well, and if I might add to that, also what's going on, of course, as many of you who authors who end up writing a book, of course, you perhaps started with even blogging each one of those chapters or some version of it, and then felt recognized the opportunity to pull it together in a different way. Or what we've done here on Circles of Change, of course, with Diane Turner, my one guest who just preceded you, she did multiple radio shows and then said, whoa, I've got a book here, based on even having engaged through the media of conversation, too.
Uh-huh. Well, that's right. So, if anybody wants to write a book, I have so many people come up to there and say, after our speech, gee, I want to write a book. And I say, well, so what are you writing on?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm not writing. I just want to write a book.
Right.
So the bottom line is, if you want to write a book, just start writing something today and try to write every day or as close to every day as you can. Become a writer before you become an author, because you can't become a very good author without being a writer. And I started my blog in 2006, and I got a good following relatively quickly, but I go back and read some of my writing now after I've spent 7 years writing. And writing 4 books, and I'm a much better writer now. And it's just, it's like when I get in shape, you can't just say, oh, I want to look like that.
Right, or I'm going to run a marathon now. Yep, you can't.
Yeah,
well,
right,
having said that, you do have multiple books that have been published. Based on the reaction you've gotten so far then, for this one coming out, is there anything different at play then for you at this point, David, with your new book, Entering the Shift Age?
Well, it's really the summation of, I think it's the book I'm going to be known for relative to The Shift Age. The first book, The Shift Age, that came out was a high level, put the concept out, aggregate some blog columns, rewrite them. Then I've been speaking. I've had like 500 speeches since that book came out, all around the world, all 6 continents. And I've learned things. People can go to my website, davidhoole.com, and see all the forecasts I've made and when I made them. So so Entering the Shift Age is kind of the summation of all of that, of the first vision, the developing vision, the correctness of the vision, the universality that I now know that it is, having spoken to tens of thousands of people and all the people who bought my books. And so I think what this really is, it's 2 years worth of work, a year worth of updated research, and a year of writing. And if anybody really wants to understand, the way I describe this book is, if you are at all concerned about the future, if you're upset or disoriented about the speed of change around you, what entering the shift age does is it gives you the larger framework of the age we're in, gives you the context that you, through which you can better understand the changes that are going on, and then it gives a roadmap of humanity's future in different categories like energy, education, healthcare, things like that. So it really is a book for people who want to get a better grasp on where humanity is going and might be going.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well put. David, with your background in art history and, again, continuing to stay connected through the arts and creativity, as you mentioned, with your association at Ringling College, what about your own personal art? Does it express in any certain way beyond your writing, of course?
When I was a young man, I used to paint, and then I said, look, there's too many great painters. There's too many great works of art, so I'm not going to paint. And I loosely decided as a young man that I'd try to make my life a work of art. And there's good canvases in my life and bad canvases in my life, but I've tried to live my life as a work of art. And so that's how I look at it. Most of what would be traditionally categorized in creative effort is, mm-hmm. for me, writing and speaking and presenting. I am most who I am when I write about the future, speak about the future.
That's a lovely way to put it.
And for me, that's the dynamic creative part of my life.
But if you think about, too, that the investment of the period of time for 20-some-odd years launching in significant entertainment networks such as MTV, Nickelodeon, VH1, and as well the news side with CNN, those were very futuristic things that you and your colleagues were involved in even back then, weren't they?
Yes, absolutely. I just gave a commencement address 2 weeks ago today.
Mm-hmm.
No, a week ago today, sorry. I travel a bit much. I left the graduates with a quote that has always driven me all my life because of that. I've always done things that people said wouldn't work. I've always done things before people even knew what was going on. You know, getting into cable early, getting into internet early, creating online courses 15 years ago, people said it wouldn't work. Mm-hmm. The quote is from Schopenhauer, the Spanish philosopher. And the quote goes as follows. In the revelation of any truth, there are three stages. In the first, it is ridiculed. In the second, it is resisted. And in the third, it is considered self-evident. And that's, if you think about it, you think, oh, the world is flat. Now, that's ridiculous, but that was what it was. Or anything. So whenever I see resistance, like I saw great resistance to healthcare reform, I knew it would be self-evident. When I see over this long scale the kind of decline of nationalism and the kind of last gasp, violent uprising of fundamentalism in all religions.
Mm-hmm.
So I just know I can see the change. So in the revelation of any truth, there are three stages. The first is ridiculed, the second resisted, third considered self-evident.
That's right. Well, what a wonderful way to close up and wrap the section out. It's right there. Again, our guest has been David Hull. His book is Entering the Shift Age, the End of the Information Age and the New Era of Transformation. Please go visit his blog at evolutionshift.com. And like you started out, I started out saying, you know what, folks? It's time to pay attention to what Dave said, because there's no going back to the way things were, is it? Very good. David,
nope.
Thank you so much for joining us here on Circles of Change.
So thank you so much for having me, and have a great weekend. And everybody listening, have a great weekend.
We sure will. Change is chaotic. That is, unless you embrace it, going places you hadn't dreamed were possible. The Larson Group, Architects of Change, is a leadership consulting, executive coaching, and career transition firm. We help individuals make the most of their current employment situation or to step forward confidently into a career transition. Contact us at thelarsongroup.com or toll-free 1-877-544-2580. The Larson Group, Architects of Change, helping others unleash potential through transformational change. 1-877-544-2580.